Hello, this is John Ivey from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the June 28, 2010 issue of Sports Illustrated. We're going to begin our first article from the world of World Cup soccer. The article's entitled, The World's a Stage. As the tournament nears the knockout round, new images, plucky New Zealand, red-hot Chile, are emerging for a rapt global audience. Want to know the great thing about the World Cup? History doesn't matter. When you're staring down the goalkeeper with the ball at your feet, your reputation can't help you. Your nationality means nothing. You might as well be naked. In that moment, you reveal something raw and true. You're reacting instinctively, says Landon Donovan, the U.S.'s all-time leading goal scorer. And as good as a goalie is, a perfect shot always beats the best goalies. On a patch of grass in a teeming stadium at the bottom of Africa last Friday, Donovan had just such an encounter. As he advanced upon a Slovene goalkeeper named Samir Handanovic, Donovan could have passed the ball. That's what he had done in a similar instance at World Cup 2006, when the United States needed its best player to score against Ghana to avoid elimination. This time, though, Donovan wound up and fired from close range at an acute angle up toward the goalkeeper's head. The shot's force surprised the 6'5 Handanovic, who flinched as though he'd heard a shotgun blast, and the ball might still be in a low orbit had it not been contained by the roof of the Slovenian net. It was a classic World Cup highlight, the kind that laid bare the psyches of two men before a global audience and kick-started a furious United States comeback from a 2-0 halftime deficit. The 2-2 tie at Johannesburg's Ellis Park, marred only by a Malayan referee, Koman Kalabali's unexplained decision to disallow the game-winning United States goal, put the Americans in position to advance to the round of 16 with a victory against Algeria on Wednesday. Of course, Donovan's Daria discovery wasn't the only truth-telling moment in the opening stages of World Cup 2010, a tournament that unveiled a slew of fresh talents and stories while teaching us new things, good and bad, about familiar faces. Who knows, after all, that New Zealand, ranked 78th in the world, had the fortitude to match reigning champion Italy blow for blow in a 1-1 draw just 5 days after Kiwi forward Winston Reid, 21, provided the greatest moment in the nation's soccer history by scoring on a gorgeous header in injury time to tie Slovakia. Who knew that Switzerland, the home of watchmakers and normally dour soccer teams, would pull off the first major upset, a 1-0 thriller against European champion Spain? And who knew that England, a pre-tournament favorite to reach the semifinals, would turn in back-to-back uninspired performances in ties against the United States and Algeria? Nice to see your own fans booing you. That's what loyal support is, snapped England star Wayne Rooney after the Algeria game, a sign that the pressure of the World Cup can get to even the most seasoned players. He later apologized. Other big names struggled too. France sent home forward Nicolas Anelka after he profanely insulted coach Raymond Domenech, who was already beleaguered following a tie with Uruguay and a 2-0 loss to Mexico. Likewise, Spain's star-studded lineup failed to shed its tag of World Cup choker, dominating possession against the Swiss but missing numerous chances. And while Germany was electric in its opening 4-0 rout of Australia, it came back to earth with a thud after top scorer Miroslav Klose got sent off for two foolish first-half yellow cards in a 1-0 loss to Serbia. Still, several familiar figures backed up their resumes and even showed us new things in the process. Macon, Brazil's relentless right back, scored the goal of the first week, barreling forward against North Korea and hitting an impossibly angled strike from the touchline. Controversial Argentina manager Diego Maradona revealed he might be able to coach after all, drawing two dominant games out of Lionel Messi, the world's best player. and even a solid but unspectacular veteran like United States right back Steve Cherundolo displayed a new side, not just on the field where he was one of the team's best players, but also inside the camp where he came up with the idea of having the U.S. players put their hands over their teammates' shoulders during the national anthem. "We feel like brothers," says goalkeeper Tim Howard, "and we wanted to bring that sense of brotherhood out." One of the most exciting aspects of any World Cup is the emergence of young talent, and South Africa is no different. Chilean right winger Alexis Sanchez, 21, terrorized Honduras and Switzerland in 1-0 victories with his explosive attacks and nimble footwork. German midfielder Mesut Ozil, 21, looked to be his team's most dangerous player. And Mexican forward Javier Chicharito Hernandez, 22, struck the game winner in the defeat of France to show the world why Manchester United recently bought him from Chivas de Guadalajara for $10 million. By week's end, several trends were starting to emerge. Scoring was rare. In the openers for each of the 32 teams, there was a historic paucity of goals. Only 25, or 12 fewer than the lowest total in the point of any World Cup in the 32-team beginning in 1988. Pundits floated a number of explanations: increased parity, conservative tactics, high altitude, and the new ball, which appeared difficult for free-kick experts to bend into the net. But the United States' 5-goal shootout with Slovenia was part of a scoring uptick. Teams produced 42 goals in the second block of 16 games, more than the same stretches in 2006 and 2002, suggesting that perhaps the cool southern hemisphere winter was providing an ideal atmosphere for attacking soccer. South America was surging. The continent's 5 teams were a combined 8-2-0 through the first 2 group stages. Stage games easily the best showing of any confederation. Brazil had been Brazil, winning its first 2 matches in the tournament's hardest group, while Argentina had started tapping its vast talent resources in victories against Nigeria and South Korea. But the big surprises were Uruguay, which tied France and blew out host South Africa 3-0. Paraguay, which tied reigning World Cup champion Italy and beat Slovakia to stand atop Group F. And Chile, which played some of the Cup's most entertaining soccer under coach Marcelino Bielsa of Argentina. As a result, all 5 South American teams were in good position to reach the second round. Africa was struggling. The expected home continent advantage never materialized. In Africa's first World Cup, its teams had won only once in 12 games through Monday. Ghana's 1-0 victory against Serbia. South Africa looked to be the first host nation ever to fail to advance from group play. "Well, I think it's a good goal," United States coach Bob Bradley said on Saturday after watching replays of Maurice Edu's disallowed strike, which came after the usual free quick scrum in the penalty box. "The only things that clearly could be called would be penalty kicks for us." Yet Bradley could still feel good about a couple of things. The United States had a shot at advancing, and he got to celebrate Father's Day with his son, 22-year-old midfielder Michael, who was one of the revelations of the World Cup. Not only did the younger Bradley choke the passing lanes and start the U.S. attack for 90 minutes against both England and Slovenia, but he also revealed a big game scoring touch, hitting the equalizer late against Slovenia on a gorgeous volley. As Michael said afterward, "At halftime, down 2-0, you know you've got no choice but to push the game, push the tempo, and just fight like bums to get back into it." Fight like bums. Every team needs players who can do that. Every 4 years, the World Cup proves it. And it has a picture here of Tommy Smith and his unhandled New Zealand mates playing reigning champs from Italy to a draw. Well, now let's go to golf. The U.S. Open held this year at Pebble Beach. That's in California. And the article is entitled, "Out of Nowhere." In a grueling United States Open that seemingly nobody wanted to win, little-known Graham McDowell outlasted the game's biggest stars with a game perfectly suited for a fiery Pebble Beach. And here's a big picture of Graham McDowell driving his ball on one of the holes. The driving range on a Sunday afternoon at a U.S. Open is a strangely optimistic place, as the players engage in a kind of collective denial of the horrors that are to come. In the build-up to the final round of our 110th National Championship, played last week at Pebble Beach Golf Links, Tiger Woods couldn't help but smile when he received a standing ovation just for arriving on the practice tee. The fans were hoping to recapture the energy of the day before, when Woods had reinvented himself with a 66 that propelled him to third place. One stroke back of Tiger was his old foil Ernie Els of South Africa, who were discussing various World Cup developments in between carefree swings. Phil Mickelson was in the mix too, tied for sixth, a stroke behind Els. No one knows better than Mickelson how brutally unforgiving the Open can be, but in the minute before his reckoning, a 1:55 tee time, he was his usual jaunty self. Leaving the range, Mickelson was asked what a 65 might do for him. Same thing it did for Arnold, he cowered. He crowed, a nod to Palmer's famous final round charge of victory at Cherry Hills a half century ago. Phil, Tiger, and Ernie accounted for all of the one-name star power. But the most intriguing range rat was Dustin Johnson, who was effortlessly smashing one perfect drive after another with his vortex-inducing swing. The day before, Johnson, 25, had fired a 66 to build a three-stroke lead. It was the kind of overpowering, game-changing performance that immediately drew comparisons with Woods, circa April 1997. Johnson's friend, Steve Flesh, a longtime PGA Tour veteran, offered this by way of text message. Dustin is probably the most athletic, fearless, and supremely talented player on tour today. He has all the elements to become a dominant player. If Johnson was feeling pressured to live up to those kinds of expectations, it didn't show. As between boom bombs, he was yucking it up with his caddy and with his new swing coach, Butch Harmon. "He looks real tight, doesn't he?" Harmon said, addressing a couple of reporters. Finding comfort on the driving range is a purely physical act, but the final round of the Open is the ultimate mental test, an 18-hole stress fest designed to push players to the breaking point. However, Lucy Goosey, the protagonist, had appeared at the range. They were overmatched once they set foot on a firm and fast Pebble Beach. Woods bogeyed half of his first six holes as every part of his game betrayed him. Afterward, golf's ultimate winner was left with only moral victories. "I feel like I put some pieces together this week," Woods said. "It's a long process." The protagonists were overmatched once they set foot on a firm and fast Pebble Beach. Making the turn, Mickelson was even par for the tournament, what would ultimately be Graham McDowell's winning score. But he played the back nine in a 3-over-39, failing to make a birdie in the final 17 holes. Five times an Open runner-up, Mickelson was forced to find gallows humor in his fourth-place tie. "I'm glad it wasn't a second." Els was tied for the lead standing on the seventh tee, but he dumped two shots in the hazard on the tenth hole en route to a double bogey and then staggered home with three more bogeys. And it has pictures here of Dustin Johnson attempting a shot left-handed, even though he's a right-handed player. And then has another picture of Tiger Woods in some sort of trouble swinging out. He's in a hay farm. "Trouble, trouble everywhere. From left on Sunday, Johnson swung left-handed en route to a triple bogey at the second. Wood was on wayward with his tee shot at the third." Then a picture here of Phil Mickelson eyeing a putt. Mickelson's putter let him down, and Els was done by a double bogey at the tenth. Well, these were bruising, missed opportunities for players who each, for every personal reason, craved this Open. But Johnson's demise easily came with the most pathos. After a perfect drive on the par four second hole, his fanned approach shot hung up in the long fescue that framed a greenside bunker. With no stance, he was forced to turn his wedge upside down and gouged the ball out left-handed. He followed with a near whiff from the rough and a blown four-footer, taking a stunning triple bogey that then threw the final round into disarray. Arriving on the tee of the sharply dog-leg par-4 third hole, The hyper-aggressive Johnson instinctively pulled his driver out of the bag. He yanked his tee shot way left, and the ball was lost in a hazard, leading to a double bogey. Recklessly, Johnson then tried to drive the par 4 fourth hole and promptly dumped his ball into Stillwater Cove. In four holes, he had hit for the cycle: par, triple, triple bogey, double bogey, bogey. Johnson's coronation would have to wait, and he spent the next 14 holes in a glassy-eyed daze, ultimately signing for an 82 that was the worst final round by a 54-hole United States Open leader since Fred McLeod's 83 in 1911. An hour after the death march had finally mercifully ended, Johnson was still trying to make sense of what had befallen him. "It's hard to describe the feeling," he said in his soft South Carolina drawl. "My head was spinning a little for sure. You're trying to forget about what's just happened and keep going, but it's hard to do. My approach shot on number 2. It could have easily fallen back into the bunker. If it does, it's a totally different golf tournament." He paused, searching for answers. "It's just a crazy, crazy day out there. And not just for me. At a tournament that is destined to be remembered for who lost it, the winner turned out to be an amiable lad from Northern Ireland who made only one birdie on Sunday at the 5th and played the final 10 holes in 4 over par, but still stumbled across the finish line a stroke ahead of Gregory Havret de France, the 391st ranked player in the world, who bogeyed 3 of the final 11 holes, naturally. McDowell, 30, is the first European to take the Open since Tony Jacklin in 1970, and afterward he sounded as if he could hardly believe his good fortune. "I bogeyed 9 and 10. I bogeyed 9 and 10. I looked up at the leaderboard, and I was surprised to be 2 ahead. I really was," McDowell said, "and I was surprised that Gregory Havret was the guy closest to me. No disrespect to Gregory, he's a great player, but when you have Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson and Ernie Els there, you're not expecting Gregory Havret to be the guy you've got to fend off." McDowell's bluntness is only one of his winning traits. He grew up in the shadow of famed Royal Portrush Golf Club, but his family did not have the means to be members. Instead, Graham and his 2 brothers played at Rathmore, what their father Kenny describes as a working man's club. After studying engineering and playing a little golf for Queen's College in Belfast, McDowell somehow came to the attention of the coaches at Alabama Birmingham. By his 3rd season there, 2002, McDowell was National Player of the Year. He turned pro that summer and won his 6th start on the European Tour, the Scandinavian Masters, much to the delight of his mother, Marion. "He always told her he was going to buy her a new home with his first check, and he did," says Kenny. McDowell matured into one of Europe's most reliable ball strikers, and an emphasis on upgrading his short game led to a breakthrough year in 2008 when he won the Scottish Open and a big money event in South Korea, and then displayed the killer instinct in his first Ryder Cup. Again, he was happy to share his good fortune. "He retired me from the week he won the Scottish Open," says Kenny, a former computer technician at a middle school. "He said he wanted to have me out on tour with him more. We've had a great time seeing the world together." McDowell roared into Pebble Beach fresh from another victory in Wales, but his first round 71, which left him 2 strokes off the lead, was little noticed as Woods made his long-awaited return to Pebble Beach. At the 2000 United States Open, he had smashed numerous records en route to a 15-stroke victory. Those 4 days a decade ago remained the most dominant golf of Woods' career, so this visit to Pebble Beach was a chance to assess just how far he has fallen. In a run-up to the Open, Woods had repeatedly downplayed comparisons, but once he arrived at Pebble, he appeared flummoxed, trying to live up to his own impossible standards. He did show a boil throughout a torturous, birdless 74 on Thursday. He had opened in 2000 with a bogeyless 65. Afterward, while awaiting a TV interview, a frustrated Woods mumbled under his breath, "Mother." More out of character was his moaning about the bumpiness of the greens. Jack Nicklaus used to say that he loved to hear other players whining about the conditions at a major championship because he knew they were already beaten mentally. Woods played the next morning on greens that McDowell, in the same early wave, described as very pure. So Tiger was out of excuses for a raging ragtag 72 that left him in 25th place, even seven back of the Ulsterman who shot a 68. 10 years ago, Woods' 69 propelled him six strokes ahead at the midway point. In the ensuing edition of the Monterey Herald, Woods' post first birdie was the headline, because it indeed was newsworthy. Typical of his subtle mind games between the world's two best players, Mickelson went out of his way to praise the greens, saying that his maddening first-round 75, during which he hit two balls into the Pacific and also failed to make a birdie, were the result of poor putting. But Mickelson is as unpredictable as the pebble weather, and he responded on Friday with a flawless 66 to surge into a tie for second, two strokes behind McDowell. "Certainly was the best I've ever seen him play," said playing partner Padraig Harrington. "It was as easy a 66 as you'll ever see." Phil being Phil, his third round featured three balls dumped into the Oceanside hazard, and he needed what he called various salty up-and-downs to salvage a 73. He reluctantly ceded the spotlight to Woods, who had begun his round with soft bogeys on the second and third holes to free fall to six over par. The instant verdict in the press room, on Twitter and elsewhere, was that his tournament was over. But then the damnedest thing happened. Tiger Woods turned into Tiger Woods. Post-scandal, his golf has been meek and unsteady, and he has often had mopey body language and a fairway look in his eyes, faraway look in his eyes. Three birdies in a row, beginning on the fourth hole, changed all that. Woods' fist pumps became more demonstrative, and in turn the crowd throatier. On the par 4 13th hole, Tiger did a familiar cocky twirl of his club, and even before his ball almost hit the flagstick, after that the birdie putt dropped. The whole course seemed to tilt in his direction. A big breaking birdie putt on 16 brought the biggest fist pump of 2010. At the par 5 18th from 260 yards out, he carved a 3-wood around a tree over the ocean and onto the green, the most macho shot Woods has hit this season. And yet Johnson matched Woods' 66 blow for blow. The signature moment was when Johnson made eagle by driving the uphill 290-yard par 4 fourth hole with a 3-iron. Johnson took a two-stroke lead to the 18th tee and promptly whipped out his driver, leading to an on-air scolding by NBC's Johnny Miller, who favored a more conservative play on the watery par 5. As it turned out, Johnson blasted his drive well past the lurking trees and bunkers down the right side and had only a 6-iron in, which he deftly placed on the left side of the green, leading to one last birdie. Old Johnny hit it for about 210 off the tee in his prime, woofed Alan Terrell, Johnson's coach at Coastal Carolina. "He simply doesn't understand the game Dustin is playing." But it was Johnson's pedal-to-the-metal style that led to his implosion on Sunday. McDowell seized control of the tournament by opening with seven pars and a birdie and effectively playing prevent defense the rest of the way. Unlike previous opens at Pebble, there was no defining moment or iconic shot, but McDowell was making no apologies for being the last man standing. His father claims the best whiskey in the world is made out of Portrush in the village of Bush Mills. Graham is more of a Guinness man. Either way, the new United States Open champ said on Sunday evening, "There might be a few beverages consumed from this trophy this week. Goodness knows when I'm going to sober up. I can't make any promises there." After such a wild, demoralizing final round, the men McDowell beat at Pebble Beach will probably be driven to drink, too. All right. Well, now let's go to an article entitled "A Gift from On High." That's on page 14. "A Gift from On High." On his remarkable journey through life, Manute Bol played even bigger than his height. The voice at one end of the telephone belonged to Jimmy Lynam, who was the new coach of the Clippers. The voice at the other end of the phone belonged to high school basketball authority Howard Garfinkel, founder of the Five Stars Camps, who was seated at the team's table at the headquarters for the 1983 NBA draft in New York City. The subject of the conversation was the Clippers' pick in the fifth round. "We picked Manute Bol," Lynam told Garfinkel. "That's M-A-N-U-T-E. What's his first name? Garfinkel asked. That is his first name. His second name is Bol. That's B-O-L. Never heard of him. Where's he from? Sudan. Never heard of it. What kind of a school is that? It's not a school. It's a country. Never heard of it. This was the beginning. A fable would unfold, the tale of this 7'7" Dinka tribesman from the Sudanese jungle who had played 10 improbable years in the NBA, then become known for his great humanitarian spirit before he died last Saturday at the announced age of 47 in a Virginia hospital due to complications from kidney disease. But this was before all that, back when he was a surprise, a question, a doodle come to life from a cocktail napkin. He was tall, inordinately tall. This was his passport, his golden credit card that would make him from the Stone Age simplicity of loincloths and spears, from lions walking through the bush, to the accelerated big city civilization of the late 20th century. His height made him valuable, sight unseen. I'd grown up in Philadelphia when Wilt Chamberlain was in high school there, Lennon said. He was just God, tall as he was. He could do anything he wanted. Chamberlain was 7'1". Bol was 6 inches taller. He had been in the United States now for less than a month. 4 years earlier, he had never heard of basketball, the NBA, or even the United States. Height was height. Lynam picked him despite never having seen him play. Here's the thing. The NBA rejected the pick on some technicalities, Lynam said. They said that Manute hadn't filed to enter the draft, and they said that he was too young. Here's the thing. The NBA used his passport to say that he was only 19 years old. His passport also said he was 5'2". Manute said he was sitting down when he was measured. College basketball became Bol's next goal. That June, Cleveland State coach Kevin Mackey sent him to an instructor in English as a second language at Case Western Reserve. He was starting from ground zero, not only in English, but in 20th century culture, the instructor Arlene Bialik said. He couldn't use a telephone. He couldn't operate a Coke machine. He didn't even know how to hold a pencil. Never had done it. The lessons stretched through the next year. The basketball became much better. Bol scrimmaged in Cleveland with NBA players such as Charles Oakley, Ron Harper, Mark West, John Bagley, but the English was still not ready for the ACT or SATs. Bol spoke the language of basketball. My bad. Get that stuff out of my house, and American quiz shows, come on down. But those weren't phrases on the tests. He wound up at Division II Bridgeport for a raucous shot-blocking season in which he was allowed to take exams orally, and he compiled a 2.8 grade point average. He was a sensation wherever he went. He returned, legally this time, to the 1985 NBA draft. He was selected in the second round by the Bullets. He screws up the game more than anyone I've ever seen, Washington General Manager Bob Ferry said after watching Bol block Bill Walton's jump shot and disrupt the Celtics. He throws everybody out of sync. He continued to throw people out of sync. He played 2,624 games for four teams, averaged 2.6 points, and blocked 3.5 shots and 4.2 rebounds. I am never bothered by the fact that I am tall, he once said. When I was younger, I was bothered, but not now. My height is a gift from God. That is what I say. I did not create it. You have to live with what you are given. Who knows what God is dreaming for us? There is a reason. Look at what he has dreamed for me. And that's from Lee Montville, was a SI senior writer from 1986 to 2001. His book, Manute, The Center of Two Worlds, was published in 1993. Well, we have run out of time for today's reading of Sports Illustrated. Be sure to tune in next time, for we hope we've enjoyed it. I am John Ivey, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And the show can be readily available on podcast after this broadcast. We hope you've enjoyed it. So long, till next time.